This is Mayo Clinic Talks, a curated weekly podcast for physicians and healthcare providers. I'm your host, Daryl Chutka, a general internist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. It's estimated that about 25 million people in the U.S. have asthma, and this represents about one in every 13 individuals. It's more common in females and is a leading cause of chronic disease in children. Asthma represents a common reason for an outpatient visit and is unfortunately also a relatively common reason for hospitalization. Although it's felt that almost all deaths from asthma are preventable with appropriate management, over 3,000 people still die per year from asthma. So how do we properly evaluate patients we suspect have asthma? What are the goals for their management, and what are the current recommendations for treatment? Our topic for today's podcast is an update in asthma, and my guest is Dr. John Lewis from the Division of Allergic Disease at the Mayo Clinic. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Talks. John, welcome, and thank you for joining me today.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be able to share a few thoughts about this common disease that many of us will confront.
It is common, and it seems to be becoming more common. Is that the case?
It is. This is particularly true in the last quarter of the 20th century, when even over a single decade, there was over a 45% increase in the number of cases seen in the United States. There's continued to be some increase in cases in the U.S. and worldwide into the 21st century, although it may have leveled off now a little bit since 2009 for reasons not entirely clear. But certainly it has been a disease that has been on the ascendancy in our lifetimes.
Mm-hmm. But the reason for this increase really isn't known.
That's true. There's many theories for why that might be happening. Currently popular is the idea of climate change. But I think there's been a number of changes in how we live our lives that have occurred in more recent times. We're spending a lot more time indoors. We're more sedentary. We are exposed to various indoor irritants and allergens, and the allergy world in particular, dust mites and cockroaches. Obesity. Obesity is a risk factor for asthma, and certainly we've seen an epidemic of obesity, not only here, but unfortunately now spreading around the world. And these are probably some of the factors in the rise of asthma. You know, probably there's greater recognition of asthma too by clinicians, but we think that the rise in cases is occurring independent of our increased clinical acumen in diagnosing asthma.
Sure. Okay. Well, can you review for our listeners the pathophysiology of asthma? What's going on in our lungs and airways?
I would say that there's two main features to asthma pathophysiology. One is an inflammatory process that's taking place, most commonly eosinophilic, but also in some patients more neutrophilic, and in others more of a mixed pattern. And in fact, it can change over time and certainly vary in the intensity of the inflammation. In addition, if we were to look at the histopathology of the bronchi, we would see changes like loss of normal epithelium. We would see vascular congestion. We would see smooth muscle hypertrophy. We would see mucus gland hyperplasia and hypersecretion. So it bears a clear histopathologic picture. The other aspect that's key is this concept of bronchial hyperreactivity or reversible airflow dynamics. The characteristic pattern is that of obstruction based on spirometric measures, where we have an FEV1 to FEC ratio that is less than expected for the individual based on their sex, their age, and their height, and changes in variability of their performance. Typically, most people doing spirometric measures, their FEV1s will be within about 5% of one another from effort to effort. And in sort of like asthma, we tend to see much greater swings in their FEV1s, either spontaneously or with the intervention of medications and control of their disease. Conversely, if we have somebody who has normal pulmonary functions, then we might consider a challenge test. in the United States, this will most commonly be with a substance called methacholine. Mm-hmm. But there's also other substances that we could have the subjects inhale or have them do an exercise test and look to see if we see a drop in their FEV1 beyond that would be expected in normal airways. I think a characteristic feature is, in fact, the variation and variability in the degree of inflammation and in the degree of bronchoconstriction over time. That, in fact, is a characteristic of asthma that we may not see in other diseases such as COPD, where you have more fixed airway obstruction.
It seems that the vast majority of patients I've seen who have asthma developed it very early in life. Is it unusual to get asthma later in life?
So I think your observations would be accurate in that it is more common in youths. However, it could develop at any time during an individual's lifetime.
You mentioned obesity being one of the risk factors for asthma. Mm-hmm. What are the others?
So one of the chief risk factors, and speaking as an allergist, this is near and dear, and that would be the atopic state. If we see a family history of atopy or a personal history of atopy, where atopy is this triad of eczema, allergic rhinitis, and asthma, they're genetically linked. And if we see that sort of disorder or those disorders occurring in family or in the individual, that certainly heightens our suspicion for them also having asthma. Some individuals may just demonstrate one of those. Some may demonstrate two of those. Sometimes there's what's known as the atopic march from eczema to allergic rhinitis and on to asthma. That's a fairly classic picture in childhood. On the other side, though, the absence of allergy does not rule out the possibility of asthma.
It certainly seems, though, that the majority of patients with asthma also have a history of seasonal allergies or allergy to other substances. You're right.
That's true. If we look at childhood asthma, it's estimated that about 90% of childhood asthmatics are allergic. If we look at the adult population, it's closer to 50%. And if we group them all together, it's estimated in the U.S. that about 60% of our patients with asthma have some aeroallergen sensitivity that could well be relevant in terms of their airway inflammation and hyperreactivity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that exercise, maybe exposure to cold air can be some triggers for asthma. What are some other common triggers for setting off an asthma attack?
Yeah. So one of the most common and most difficult to manage would be viral respiratory infections. People who have asthma are more prone to get these viral infections. They tend to be more severe than the same virus experienced in somebody without asthma. And the inflammation created by that virus is more robust than in the non-asthmatic. And as a consequence, even after the actual viral infection has now been dealt with by your immune system, the amount of inflammation that is still residual from the infection can be such that the individual's symptoms may linger on for weeks after a significant viral respiratory infection.
But it seems that like the trademark of asthma is its reversibility. But over time, the lifetime of asthma, does it cause chronic lung disease?
So unfortunately, in a subset of asthmatics, it can. This irreversibility is thought of as scarring that occurs in the airways. Typically, we apply the term airway remodeling to this loss of reversibility or less reversibility than was seen earlier in their course. And some individuals will see this develop over time. It's thought to be a consequence of the chronic airway inflammation. And like in other tissues where there's chronic inflammation, there may be scarring that results. And other individuals, unfortunately, at the time of presentation, they may have very little bronchial hyperresponsiveness or less than desired response to our various treatments for bronchoconstriction.
Okay. Seems like there are not a lot of benefits to aging. Things don't seem to be getting better. They always seem to be getting worse. But I think one of the things that seems to be getting better is I see fewer allergies in patients who are older and less asthma. Does it resolve over time in some patients?
I would hesitate to say resolve. I frame it more in terms of they may have improvement in their symptoms. I would perhaps liken it to somebody who has migraines. And they, if they've had a good spell without migraines, I'm very happy for them, but I'd be hesitant to say that they would never have a migraine again. Mm-hmm. And because of the genetics of asthma, and by the way, there's over 100 genes associated with risk for asthma, since that genetic tendency remains, I would say that the intensity or frequency of their symptoms may wax and wane and come and go over time. But the underlying tendency to have their asthma be active still remains. Further, it may morph in its characteristics. For instance, we see many adults who had childhood asthma and very clearly recall being short of breath, wheezing, being in the emergency room or in the hospital. And now we're seeing them in midlife, and their chief symptom may be cough. No real wheezing, no real tightness. They may not have any exercise limitations. It's cough. But when we dig into it, we find out that now they have what we might refer to as cough variant asthma, which is just another face of their disease. Often these individuals are shocked to learn that this is sort of a resurgence of their asthma and had never thought of it being asthma because they were so familiar with the other symptoms that they experienced earlier in life, and those being often quite severe during their childhood. So I think, you know, this sort of variability in the intensity of the disease and how it affects their lives, it's characteristic of asthma. And for many, it's fortunate. Many, once they reach their late teens and early 20s, notice significant improvement or drop off in their symptoms, but that may not be a lifelong escape from their symptoms. And it's estimated that about 75% of children will actually continue to have some asthma as an adult. If you have adult onset asthma, which is a specific phenotype, that is even less likely to resolve or significantly improve.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know there's at least a couple ways of categorizing asthma. Can you review those with us?
Yeah, certainly. So one way might be to describe asthma phenotypes. And there's various phenotypes or clinical pictures that have been described. Gina, the Global Initiative for Asthma, talks about allergic phenotype, a non-allergic phenotype, a phenotype associated with obesity, adult onset asthma, as we already mentioned, and asthmatics in whom they've developed some persistent airway obstruction that is not reversible. So that's sort of the phenotypic description of asthma from the clinical standpoint. I would say the phenotypes, though, are not neatly separated out one from another, and there can be overlap, and individuals can migrate more from one phenotype to another over time. The other classification system is perhaps more familiar to many of us, and that classifies by the degree of severity, which would be the frequency of symptoms, the severity of their symptoms, and the amount of medication it takes to bring them under control. These would be the categories such as mild and intermittent, and mild, moderate, and severe persistent asthma. So that's sort of an alternative way of describing these individuals.
Mm-hmm. Earlier, you mentioned some of the tests that we often use to assess patients who have asthma. Let's say we have a patient in our office, no diagnosis of asthma, but based on their symptoms, we suspect they may have asthma. How do we approach them? What questions do we ask them? And what do we find on physical? And then how do we approach testing them?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, certainly it starts with the history, as you suggested. And we're looking for symptoms such as cough and wheeze and tightness and shortness of breath and perhaps poor exercise tolerance. And asthma often has a nocturnal component when it is active. And again, the variability. So we're interested, are there certain situations or times of the year in which you find that your symptoms will typically flare or remit? We look at things like exposure to airborne allergens and irritants, smoking. Irritants, by the way, would encompass things such as smoke, regardless of the source. Cold, dry air, as you've mentioned, is quite provocative. Emotion, all of these things are potential triggers. So if we hear those sorts of things, we think of asthma. Also, we ask about a personal history of atopy. Have they had allergic rhinitis? Have they had eczema? And has there been any previous diagnosis for their symptoms? And if so, what evaluation has been done? We're interested also if there's a family history of atopy, because of such a strong correlation with atopy in the family and with an individual's risk for having asthma. We then also want to get some objective data. And for us, that means pulmonary function testing, preferably spirometry, and typically pre and post bronchodilator, looking to see if we see an improvement of 12% in the FEV1 and greater than 200 milliliters. I would caution, though, that it all depends when you're testing the patient. So you may catch them at a time when you'll see that reversibility, but because of the varying intensity of the inflammation, the varying degrees of bronchoconstriction that can exist in these patients, you might test them on a day in which you just simply don't see reversibility. And yet, if you test them on another day, you may see that. The same is true with provocative tests such as the methacholine challenge, that depending on where they are in their disease journey, when we test them, we may or may not see a drop in their FEV1. In the case of methacholine, what we're looking for is a 20% drop. With exercise, we're looking for a 15% drop. But again, depending on the circumstances, we may not see that. And I think this is a really important point, that if you see something on the breathing test, you got lucky and caught the fish that day. But if you don't see it, it doesn't necessarily mean it's never there. And the serial pulmonary function testing is really important to help us in making the diagnosis and following the clinical course to see how we're doing with our various interventions. So as a specialist, I would like to emphasize that importance of one set of pulmonary functions may well not be enough, and that you may need to follow these over time to look for that degree of variability. Now, spirometry is clearly the recommended form of testing, and looking for obstruction, which is defined as an FEV1 to FEC ratio, which is less than predicted. But it's not always possible, and particularly if we're looking at this as a global problem, or even in our own community, spirometry is not always available for our patients. And in that case, a peak flow reading would be our next best option in order to try and objectify the status of their airway function. The peak flow is actually a better measure for large airway obstruction than it is for medium or small airway obstruction. And this is one of the reasons it's not our preferred choice. But if we're using peak flow meter monitoring, we're typically looking for swings of 20% or greater in their performance over time, or with the administration of a bronchodilator, or perhaps after initiating asthma therapy and seeing an improvement in the peak flow. But again, spirometry is our preferred study. Mm-hmm. Also, we have exhaled nitric oxides, and those are a little bit more controversial. And there's some question about how useful they are in making the diagnosis of asthma. I would argue, though, it's probably of some interest to know whether they have eosinophilic airway inflammation when we're testing them, which would be indicated by an elevated exhaled nitric oxide. I think it's more of proven value for following asthma treatment and seeing how well our interventions are controlling the eosinophilic asthma phenotype over time. I will tell you that in our division, we routinely order the exhaled nitric oxide as an adjunct to the spirometry.
Because of the reversibility of asthma, the physical exam of somebody having an acute asthma attack is certainly different than a person between attacks. So is there really anything on physical exam in a young patient before they develop chronic disease from asthma that we might hear?
Sure. So certainly you might hear wheezing. However, I can tell you, having listened to a lot of lungs and done pulmonary function in the same patient on the same day, that they may be quite significantly obstructed, and I will not hear that with the stethoscope. And I may not detect any real airflow limitation on them. So if present, perhaps helpful. If absent, we haven't really ruled it out. Furthermore, wheeze is not specific for asthma. This could be from the upper airways, or even in person with normal airways, if they exhale forcefully enough, we may hear a little bit of wheezing. Mm-hmm. So somewhat of use. I would say another sign that might be helpful is I find that when they're exhaling, if that triggers coughing in them or then triggers some wheezing in them, that that's often a useful sign that they have underlying airway inflammation. Mm-hmm. Also on the exam, our patients with asthma don't get stridorous. If they're stridor, one needs to consider large airway obstruction as opposed to medium and small airway obstruction. So also when we do the exam, we're not only looking for signs of asthma, but also for other diseases which could mimic or coexist with their asthma. For instance, in asthma, we shouldn't see clubbing. If we see clubbing, we're going to certainly think of other possibilities. So that would be one example. We're also listening to their heart. I've had patients with atrial fibrillation who have come for management of their asthma, patients with aortic stenosis, where that's the reason why they have dyspnea, congestive heart failure, and others. So we're looking for the possibility of other disorders that might be faking us out or coexist with their asthma.
Okay. Well, let's now change directions and talk a little bit about the approach we take when managing patients with asthma. What are our goals for asthma management?
Yeah, so they're twofold. And one is to control symptoms. That is to control their coughing, wheezing, tightness, or shortness of breath, both during the day and during the night, and at rest and with exertion. So basically, we don't want their asthma interfering with the things that they wish to do. The other side of the coin is their performance on the pulmonary function tests. There, we would really like to optimize them. And when we're interpreting pulmonary functions, we actually sort of use two phrases. One is normal or abnormal, and the other is personal best. And that personal best really may be more of our goal for that individual. Pulmonary function tests, when we're talking about normal or abnormal and mild, moderate, or severe, we're comparing the individual with a cohort of people whom we think share similar features, such as their age and their height and their sex. But in truth, there's a lot of variation. So that cohort may not really be appropriate for this given patient. And I have many patients who, on a good day, their FEV1 could be 120% of predicted or 130% of predicted. And so if I'm just comparing with their cohort and they come in one day and they're blowing 100%, that's their FEV1, actually for them, that's down 20 or 30%, which unless I had the serial pulmonary functions to know that, I would not have known. And I would be thinking that if they weren't too symptomatic, I was doing really well with their treatment. Conversely, they may have some permanent obstruction, and it may not be realistic for somebody whose FEV1 is and has been and will be, say, 65%. It then becomes sort of unrealistic to expect them to be in the normal range if we put them on all the appropriate medications and an FEV1 of 65% is the best we're going to do. That becomes their benchmark. So the personal best becomes a nice benchmark moving forward for management of that particular patient.
Well, fortunately, we've got a fair number of pharmacologic options now available for treating asthma. How do we use them? How do we start treatment based on their symptoms? How far do we go with pharmacologic therapy?
So you're right. Fortunately, we have an ever-increasing list of medications. The short-acting beta agonists, the long-acting beta agonists, the muscarinic antagonists, certainly the inhaled corticosteroids in various strengths, and then combination inhalers, the dual inhalers and now triple agent inhalers. And in addition, we have systemic corticosteroids, which typically is the bailout for our patients when their asthma is falling out of control despite being on their medications. And now we have the biologics. So these are often useful when we get to step five in our treatment algorithms, where we already have them on good doses of inhaled corticosteroids, long-acting beta agonist, long-acting muscarinic antagonist, that the biologics become an excellent option for us, particularly as we try and spare the use of systemic steroids. So we have anti-IgE, we have three different biologics targeting the eosinophil, we have one that targets IL-5 and IL-13, and now a newer one which targets thymic stromal lymphopoietin. So those are very useful adjuncts that we have. And we have to basically individualize treatment in terms of finding which group of medications. I mean, we have general treatment principles based on successes with other patients and based on treatment algorithms and guidelines, but it all comes down to individualizing the needs for that patient and also understanding that what they need this year may not necessarily be what they need next year. We may need to step up or step down their therapy dictated by their symptom control and their performance on the breathing tests.
So just a reminder that asthma is a chronic disease and it does change. So it is important to see these patients back periodically.
It is. This becomes a practical problem of getting patients in our busy calendars. I think of managing asthma is somewhat akin to how you would manage a diabetic. You wouldn't get a single blood sugar, glycosylated hemoglobin, and do the basic tests and then say goodbye for a few years. Or as we manage high blood pressure, you might make an intervention, but then you have to follow up and see how that's working out in terms of controlling their blood pressure and having side effects, that sort of thing. So I really view it as an ongoing process. Another part of treatment, I think, is non-pharmacologic, and that is education. This is really huge. Trying to explain to the patient what we think is the underlying pathophysiology, how the medications work, how they are to be used. That includes inhaler technique. Very often, patients are not using their metered dose inhalers correctly, so they're not getting optimal delivery to their lower airways of these costly and time-consuming medications that we're asking them to take. So I think it's really important that they try and understand how those medications work and what they can do for them, and it's a chronic condition. Unfortunately, it's understandable and very human, but patients often construe the absence of symptoms for the absence of a problem. We would view it as, oh, good, we've got you under control. They are ever hopeful and thinking, I'm cured. That tends to lead to them reducing their medications. And in fact, when we look at compliance or adherence to medication use in asthmatics, it's pretty abysmal. It's estimated somewhere between 30 to 70% of asthmatics are not using their medications in the way in which we had wanted them to. So I think it's really important to enforce that and to always ask questions about what are they using? How often are they using it? How are they using it? And to reassess their education of both the asthma and the medications that we're using to control that.
Yeah, and one other area that I emphasize in my patients involving education is the importance of preventing respiratory infections with, you know, annual influenza vaccines, pneumonia vaccine, COVID immunizations, and also for smokers, it's so important for them to quit smoking.
Yes, and secondhand smoking and vaping to be avoided. Yeah. And yes, it's recommended that asthmatics, children and adults, receive an annual influenza vaccine, that they have the appropriate COVID vaccinations and pneumococcal vaccination, mm-hmm. which might not occur when you have somebody who's maybe in their 20s or 30s, although they may have had the vaccination series as a child, as it's part of the standard vaccination series for children nowadays.
Yeah. Any major breakthroughs you see in the future?
I don't see any major therapeutic breakthroughs. I think we'll continue to add to our armamentarium. And I think the major challenge we're faced with right now is, again, trying to individualize the therapy for the patient. And particularly the biologics are some of our newer agents and have proven very effective. But we're, as prescribers, we're wondering which of the biologics for which patient. And we're waiting for results on some studies to try and answer that question for us and how we can best tailor the therapy for that individual.
Well, we've been discussing an update in asthma with Dr. John Lewis, a specialist in allergic diseases and asthma from the Mayo Clinic. John, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us today. You've given us a lot of information. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jero. It's been a pleasure.
You can now listen to over 100 different medical topics developed for primary care providers on Mayo Clinic Talks podcasts. Find them at ce.mayo.edu or your favorite podcasting app. If you've enjoyed Mayo Clinic Talks podcasts, please follow us. Stay healthy and see you next week.